Chapter 4. A Leap of Faith. "What is this wisdom? Whose and whence?" he queries. And then he finds that all these dharmas are entirely empty. Uncowed and fearless in the face of that discovery, not far from Bodhi is that Bodhi being then. Our doubts and questions are resolved when we realize that no objects of thought denote existing entities or realities, which are empty or indefinable, and thus not completely amenable to logical treatment. The discovery of the emptiness of all dharmas is a non-rational one, but going beyond the limits of reason, the Bodhisattva remains uncowed and fearless. Offering the term indefinable for shunya is not to suggest that we translate shunyata as the indefinable, like the unconditioned or the absolute. The teaching of shunyata tries to communicate to us the fact that reality, experience, life, cannot be adequately and fully represented by thought. Thought is not equal to or commensurate with experience. Experience transcends thought. To speak of shunyata as the open-ended dimension of being, as Dr. Gunther does, perhaps comes too close to being a definition. Is life literally open-ended? If we use an expression like this, it is only as a pointer, a warning, not to try to superimpose our conceptual categories too rigidly upon life. According to the Prajnaparamita, there are 20 kinds of shunyata. We can say, for example, that something is shunya in the sense of being completely non-existent. That which is illusory can be described as void in the sense that it isn't there at all. When we talk about the relatively real as being shunya, however, shunya cannot in this context be translated as non-existent. The relatively real arises in dependence upon causes and conditions, and ceases when those causes and conditions disappear. So in this case, shunya means relative, or empirically existent, or conditioned, not non-existent. As for when we say that nirvana is shunya, this means that nirvana is empty of the whole cause-effect process, that there is nothing in it of conditioned existence. It does not mean that nirvana is completely non-existent. Then, in the highest sense, we can speak of the shunyata of the Dharmakaya. This means that the Dharmakaya is empty of all discriminations. We cannot say that it is existent or non-existent, shunya or ashunya, void or not void. It transcends all these terms. It is completely empty, but not, again, simply non-existent. If one says, "Oh, in Buddhism everything is void," one lets oneself in for endless misunderstandings. One should never use the term voidness or emptiness at all without carefully relating it to its appropriate context. It's not a thing to be described, but more like a mode of being. If your experience is an experience of shunyata, then you will see whatever you come into contact with as shunyata. It is like the experience of metta. Any person, indeed any sentient being, that comes within the range of your metta will become an object of that metta. The person hasn't changed, but at the same time, for you, they have changed. People who seemed pretty dreadful or despicable before now seem lovable, attractive, and appealing. In the same way, when insight has arisen, you see and experience as shunyata anything that happens to come within your spiritual vision, to the extent that you perceive and experience it at all. To course in the skandhas, in form, in feeling, in perception, will, and so on, and fail to consider them wisely, or to imagine these skandhas as being empty, means to course in the sign, the track of non-production ignored. Don't imagine the skandhas as being empty, if this means positing an actual entity or something that the skandhas really are, which is qualified and thus substantiated by something called emptiness. To say that the skandhas are empty is just a way of saying that they are not to be taken literally or at their face value. To imagine the skandhas as being really and truly empty means to course in the sign. That is, it means to take something which is only a provisional and relative existence as being ultimately real. It means we have not realized the non-production of things. Non-production is an important concept, or rather non-concept, of the Mahayana, traditionally illustrated by the conjurer's magical show. If a conjurer conjures up horses and elephants, so that you see what appear to be horses and elephants, have these horses and elephants really come into existence? Have they actually been produced? No, they may appear to be being produced, but in reality nothing has been produced at all. Likewise, the Bodhisattva sees all phenomena which appear to be produced as like a mirage or a magical show. They are perceived, and they exist in the sense that they are perceived, but they are not ultimately real. There is therefore no question of their being produced as such. The Bodhisattva sees dharmas, all phenomenal things, as just appearing like a mirage in the desert. The mirage is seen, but it does not really exist. The non-arisen anuttpanna nature of all dharmas is connected with the practice of kshanti, patience, which is the third paramita. Strictly speaking, this paramita is called the anuttpatika dharma kshanti, the patient acceptance of the non-origination of all dharmas. This is patience in the deepest sense, as practiced by the Bodhisattva in the eighth bhumi, the eighth of the 10 stages in the progress of the Bodhisattva. It is the patient acceptance of the fact that, in their essential nature, all dharmas are non-produced. They do not actually come into existence. Everything abides in a state of quiescence, calm, shunyata, with only an appearance of things being produced, like a mirage or the magic of a conjurer. The Bodhisattva's patient acceptance of the non-origination of all dharmas is the seeing and accepting of the fact that all things are like this. This is the track or path of non-production. If the Bodhisattva were to take the absolute quiescence of all dharmas as an invitation to sit about doing nothing, however, this would imply a difference between attainment and non-attainment, when in fact, of course, they are both empty. Thus, the compassionate activity of the Bodhisattva is based not on any mundane and thus essentially self-centered humanitarian ideal, but on the realization of emptiness. When we, quote, course in the sign, unquote, we are taking all the subjectively conditioned ideas and concepts with which we invest a particular sense perception in order to make it an object of our perception, preeminently the concepts of being and non-being, as constituting the true nature of that perception. But when he does not course in form, in feeling or perception, in will or consciousness, but wanders without home, remaining unaware of coursing firm in wisdom, his thoughts on non-production, then the best of all the calming trances cleaves to him. When a Bodhisattva does not settle down in any particular set of ideas, like the five skandhas, and does not take those ideas as representing absolute realities, but remains concentrated in the patient acceptance of the non-origination of all dharmas, so that there is no self-consciousness in the firm treading of the path of wisdom, then that Bodhisattva will naturally come to dwell in the dhyanas, the blissful states of higher consciousness. Through that, the Bodhisattva now dwells tranquil in himself, his future Buddhahood assured by antecedent Buddhas. Whether absorbed in trance, or whether outside it, he minds not. For of things as they are, he knows the essential original nature. The attainment of precedent Buddhas guarantees the Bodhisattva future Buddhahood, provided that he or she makes the same effort that the previous Buddhas made before their enlightenment. The Bodhisattva understands the fundamental nature of all things, including the dhyanas, or trances, as Khonsa unfortunately translates the term, as being essentially non-arisen, non-originated, and is not therefore attached to them. Enjoyment there may be, but the Bodhisattva is not misled by that enjoyment into taking the dhyanas as existing, so to speak, in their own right. It should be said, though, that, looked at even from the relative point of view, the dhyanas are part of the phenomenal world, and as such should not be objects of attachment. Although from a Buddhist perspective these experiences are limited, they are of course very powerful, and Hindu theism is firmly based on them. To give them their due, Hindus are comparatively familiar with higher states of dhyana. It is only too easy, if we don't have much experience of these states ourselves, to criticize the Hindus for getting stuck in them. But it is also easy to get stuck in them, because they are very seductive, intoxicating states. Overflowing with bliss, you feel uplifted and joyful and carried away by a kind of divine wind. When you speak to people, they say, "Oh, you're so different from anyone I've ever met before." On the strength of that, you might start giving discourses and expounding the Bhagavad Gita. The crowds of people who flock to hear you would pretty soon be wanting to build you an ashram, saying, "You must have realized God. You're a God-realized soul." And you would no doubt start thinking, "Well, perhaps I am." In the end, you would get a few Western disciples, and then you would really be made. You would do a world tour, collect a lot of money, and build an enormous ashram. This is the story of dozens upon dozens of gurus nowadays. They are certainly not fakes. They are often very sincere, helpful, likeable people, full of emotional positivity. And it's very good that there are such people around. But you can see what the Buddha was up against, and why he adopted the attitude that he did. In India, people are all too ready to claim God-realization, and others are all too ready to credit them with it. Ordinary religious or spiritually minded people in India tend to think only in terms of dhyana or samadhi, and reckon that if you reach such a state, you are enlightened, you have realized God. They use this sort of language very easily and loosely. You can set yourself up as a guru on this sort of basis with no trouble at all, especially if you have an exuberant, lively, communicative temperament. Your exuberance is said to be the overflow of the divine bliss that you've realized. Dhyana prepares you for wisdom, but it does not take you there, because there is no dhyana apart from the person experiencing dhyana. There is nothing innate in the dhyana state that leads to wisdom, but there is something innate in you that is not satisfied by that experience, despite the egoistic tendency to settle down in it. It is the positive, concentrated energies that come from the practice of dhyana, indeed from the practice of all the paramitas, giving, morality, patience, vigour, meditation, and wisdom, that transform your purely intellectual understanding into an actual experience. But penetration into the truth comes from you as an integrated, powerful individual, possibly with the help of certain intellectual supports, as it were, derived from the tradition. This penetration into the truth brings about first insight, in the sense of vipassana, or intermittent flashes of insight,
and then gradually wisdom, pranya, which has more the nature of a permanent faculty, although the terms vipassana and pranya are sometimes roughly equated. Within Hinduism there is, of course, a tradition of jnana as well as of samadhi, and the position of Advaita Vedanta is that it is indeed jnana, or gnosis, which gives ultimate realization. From my own contact with followers of the Vedanta, however, I would say that their knowledge is almost always intellectual and rarely backed up with dhyana. There seems to be a rather strange division between the two traditions. It is extremely rare for someone to develop both jnana and dhyana. Indeed, according to a non-dualist Vedantin I met in India, spiritual practice was completely unnecessary since the world was nothing but an illusion. Even his evident ill humour was an illusion, apparently. Quite the opposite, though also in the end one-sided, was the rather more distinguished example of Ramana Maharshi. From him I got the quite distinct impression that he had had experience of the Arupa Dhyanas, the formless Dhyanas, and that he was perhaps even established in that experience, but that he did not have wisdom in the full Buddhist sense. The absence of compassion in his ashram was noticeable, in that the caste divisions were still maintained, and allowed to be maintained. A Buddhist would say that this is simply incompatible with compassion, and that without compassion there is no real wisdom. Buddhism is much more aware in this sort of way, much more critical and self-critical than Hinduism. Coursing thus, he courses in the wisdom of the Sugatas, and yet he does not apprehend the dharmas in which he courses. This coursing he wisely knows as a no-coursing. That is his practice of wisdom, the highest perfection. What exists not, that non-existent, the foolish imagine. Non-existence as well as existence they fashion. As dharmic facts, existence and non-existence are both not real. A bodhisattva goes forth when wisely he knows this. If he knows the five skandhas as like an illusion, but makes not illusion one thing and the skandhas another, if, freed from the notion of multiple things, he courses in peace, then that is his practice of wisdom, the highest perfection. It is crucial to realize that all intellectual structures, even Buddhist ones, are provisional. Their function is essentially practical, to stimulate the corresponding feelings. Ideas and concepts rest upon you. You don't rest upon them. If you get this the wrong way round, you can get into quite unnecessary semantic confusion. For example, there is apparently a semantics experiment in which you take one word from a simple, concrete sentence and define it. You then take one word from that definition and define that, and so on, until after five or six sentences, you find that you are having to use words from the first sentence in order to define the new word. The process of defining meaning is totally circular and, in its own terms, meaningless. It does not rest on anything. But actually, you would know exactly what I meant if I said, "Go through that door," because if you wanted to, and if it were possible, you could carry out the instruction. Meaning would have been communicated. The statement carries meaning because you can understand it for practical purposes. It is only if you try to go into the basic, the abstract meaning of words apart from the concrete situation in which they are used that you set yourself to go round in circles. The meaning of a word rests on the person using it, not the other way around. If you insisted on understanding the meaning of a sentence before you did anything about it, you would never get round to doing anything. It would be like demanding proof that the door is a real door, that it will actually open when you turn the handle, and that there isn't a deep ditch on the other side for you to fall into. Why not just go through the door? In the end, it comes down to faith on the one hand and fear of the unknown on the other. We know nothing in advance. You can't know what it is like to go through the door until you have gone through it. The same goes for signs and symbols. The Bodhisattva reads signs and symbols in the same way that we read road signs, simply registering what each sign conveys about the destination and the condition of the road ahead. There is no question of stopping and wondering what each square sheet of painted tin really means. Why is it blue? Why square? The Bodhisattva just sees the sign and drives on, assuming it's the right road, of course. Those with good teachers, as well as deep insight, cannot be frightened on hearing the mother's deep tenets. But those with bad teachers, who can be misled by others, are ruined thereby, as an unbaked pot when in contact with moisture.
The mother is, of course, Prajnaparamita, the mother of all the Buddhas. This verse concludes what Khonsa entitles the basic teachings, with a severe warning to handle them with extreme care. Those who do not have the sense to be able to discriminate between a good teacher and a bad one, and who do not properly exercise their own judgment, will misunderstand the perfection of wisdom and will not get the requisite guidance in its practice. To try to go beyond the intellectual categories of Buddhism before one has grasped and worked with these categories is ruinous. The perfection of wisdom needs to be approached with a sense of awe and reverence, because without a good teacher, it is very easy to get it wrong. But how can we recognize a good teacher? If there is a tendency in the teaching of Buddhism towards one particular weakness, it is a tendency towards becoming institutionalized and conformist. A useful rule of thumb that one can use to ascertain whether there is any real communication of wisdom going on between teacher and disciple is to observe how faithfully the disciples appear to follow the example of the teacher and how like-minded they are. The more closely the disciples emulate the lifestyle, temperament, and expression of the teacher, the more superficial the communication is likely to be. If the disciples are carbon copies of the teacher, this is highly suspect. It's like looking at some modern Thai paintings of scenes from the life of the Buddha, in which the Buddha is surrounded by 20 or 30 so-called disciples, all spitting images of himself. The Buddha may be distinguished by a few black curls, but otherwise they could all have popped out of one mould. If you have a very devotional guru surrounded by a lot of devotional disciples, for example, you have to be on your guard. They could just be getting on together on the basis of a common temperament, an intense kind of gregariousness, which would make it unlikely that insight is being passed on. If you have anything of wisdom to communicate to a disciple, it is something that goes beyond temperament. You have to be careful that you are communicating the truth through your own temperament and appealing to that which transcends temperament in someone else, rather than merely communicating an expression of your temperament. If you put the teaching in a certain way that appeals to someone of a certain temperament, all well and good. But this is only so that you can get the teaching accepted, so that it can go right through the temperament into the person. It is quite reassuring when a teacher who is a strict monk, leading a disciplined life in a monastery, has a faithful disciple who is laid back and anarchic and doesn't bother with robes and so on, or vice versa. Disciples might seem to teach in a completely different way from their teacher. They might even appear to be giving completely different teachings. But this may be because they are communicating the teaching to people of quite different temperaments from either their own or their teachers. No one experiences the same thing in the same way, and you have to allow for that. The medium is important, but it is not the message. We must not be misled by externals. Think of Marpa and his disciple Milarepa. Differences of temperament were transcended, and something was really passed on. You best imitate your teacher by being yourself. If you deliberately try to copy the externals, it means that you are unsure of yourself, and unsure, in the end, of your essential nature, which, like your teacher's, is shunyata. You are equally suchness, equally unique.